This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks, KBOO, for 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcasts. Friends of KBOO can be reached at 503-788-2533. Up next, the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. I wish I was a mole in the ground. Well, I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. I'm glad I'm not standing on the top. If I was standing on the top, I'd be sure to fall.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM Portland, broadcasting at 90.7 and streaming at kboo.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from a term that Karl Marx used to describe the forces of revolution, that worthy pioneer that grubs, burrows, digs, undermines, agitates, and will someday root down the mountain of capitalism that threatens to bury us all. It's no accident the Old Mole Variety Hour is hosted on KBOO FM Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station where small d democracy lives. If any listeners to The Mole are not yet members of KBOO, you can join for just $20 a year by going to the website at kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar that says Donate Today. Today, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we'll be talking about some of the art and activism that creates and commemorates the agitation of moles globally and locally. We'll be talking about solidarity and resistance, about the challenges of cooperation and the power of coalitions. Bill Resnick will be talking with Chris Tonsing of the Middle East Research and Information Project about developments in Egypt and left responses. Joe Clement will be talking about worker-owned cooperatives with a couple of wobblies in the process of setting up a worker-owned cooperative pub here in Portland. Bookmole Larry Bolden will be reviewing a 2012 novel by Susanna Moore, The Life of Objects, about European life during the Second World War. And Denise Morris will be talking with Yasmin Nair about ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, about battling discrimination against queer people, and about building the larger coalitions needed to fight at-will labor law. Let us know if you'd like to get involved with the Old Mole Variety Hour, or if you have comments, questions, kudos, or complaints, by emailing us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com, or by contacting us through our page on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour. You can also friend us, subscribe to our feed, or send us messages on Facebook. We go first to Bill Resnick talking with Chris Tonsing.
Hi, Chris. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks very much.
Chris Tonsing edits the journal Middle East Report. He writes a lot in the journal and elsewhere. And he also, for the journal, guides a great volume of Middle East studies towards publication. Chris, let's talk about Egypt. Give us an overview of last month in Egypt, what you've called in a major editorial in the journal, both a continuation of the Egyptian revolution and a military coup. Tell us what happened.
I think maybe the best way to describe what happened is that it was sort of a coup wrapped within the ongoing revolution. Egypt, since the fall of Mubarak in 2011, has been an extraordinary political and social turmoil. In 2012, just to cite one example, there were more strikes and other job actions than in both of the two preceding years combined, and that the two preceding years had already been a historic wave of worker activism. And so there's a great deal of unrest in Egypt sort of bubbling up from below that found sort of national and media-friendly expression in the huge, historically huge demonstration in Cairo on June 30th, which was calling for the removal of Mohamed Morsi, who was the president who had been democratically elected by a very slender majority just a year before. And there's a, I think, a tendency in the U.S. media to portray these events as sort of a dichotomy, that whereas Morsi and the Muslim Brothers that he represented were elected and but autocratic, that what you had happening in the next week was that you had a democratic impulse that was expressed by negating the results of elections. So for that reason, it confused a lot of people, but there's no necessary contradiction between those things. Basically, there, you know, there's no monopoly on democracy, if you will, among the different actors in Egypt. It is true at the same time that there was a coup to illegally topple an elected president, and that a substantial part of the Egyptian population, perhaps a majority, backed that measure. So we really have to step out of a model of looking at democracy as solely an exercise of going to the ballot box every 4 years in order to understand what's happening in Egypt. And basically, Egypt is, the bottom line is it's a country in extraordinary political and social turmoil. It has been the case for 3 years. And there is, I think it is fair to describe what's happening as a revolution, but it's a revolution whose outcome is extremely uncertain. And right now we're entering a phase in which the country is very polarized over the events of early July, and there are reasons for both optimism and pessimism about the way forward.
In the run-up to the coup, one enormously ironic set of circumstances, apparently the elites who the Muslim Brotherhood wanted to cooperate with in many, many ways, including by suppressing labor, and in other ways, they did not want to take on the army and thought that they could confine the army to the barracks just by giving them pretty much what they wanted in lots of areas. They also made deals with the elites and the economic elites and seemed to be following basic neoliberal propositions left over from the Mubarak era, that is, squeeze the workers and begin considering cutting food subsidies. It turned out, though, that the elites didn't want them in power anyway. They were not ready to make a deal, and they, in fact, tried to sabotage the Morsi, or did sabotage the Morsi regime by, you know, basically capital strike, is that right? And also, especially the army and the police, by, in fact, not enforcing laws, not even traffic laws, not even... and the society began, because there was no, in fact, the various sort of disciplinary mechanisms, even for lining up at gas stations, were gone, that life became even harder and harder.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a big part of the picture. There's a couple ways to tackle that question. I mean, I think at a basic level, the Muslim Brother year in government failed to address the core demands of the uprising that unseated Mubarak and sort of the ongoing revolution. So if you want to take the slogan bread, freedom, and social justice, that was kind of the baseline slogan of that uprising and the demonstrations subsequently. You're right, the Muslim Brothers did not have an alternative vision for sort of macroeconomic policy in Egypt, and they were, the policies that they were pursuing were really the same, recycled from the Mubarak era, and those were the same policies that had squeezed the middle class and squeezed the working class in Egypt for some decades and produced the conditions that led to the uprising. So people were still very upset. By the same token, the Muslim Brother government, their style of rule, was it got increasingly authoritarian. And part of the reason was that their opponents, their political opponents, refused to cooperate with them. So, but their reaction to that was, instead of reaching out to the population and trying to advance a vision that the population could relate to and would support, and thereby force the recalcitrant elements of the elite to cooperate with the brothers, their approach was akin, is actually what you would expect from a movement that had been forced to be underground for decades. They looked inward, they adopted a turtle-like posture, and basically assumed that everybody else was out to get them, and that they could only rely on their core supporters. And so they stopped really trying to be a government for all Egyptians, and they looked much more inward. And the combination of those things, the similar policies to Mubarak and the similar political attitude toward the population, that Mubarak and his predecessors had displayed, really angered a vast number of Egyptians across all kinds of demographic boundaries, by the way. And so really what you had was kind of a rebellion against the new old, if you will, elements of governance in Egypt after the fall of Mubarak. And that's I think, an indicator that the energy from the uprising itself has hardly dissipated. It's perhaps become more negative and less positive and hopeful and forward-looking than it was in 2011 at that euphoric moment when Mubarak fell, but it's still very much there. It's very much a part of what's happening. The street is a very important actor in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about both the street and what's left of an organized left, which the labor movement has been under attack and is in trouble, of course, across the world, and worker activism is being challenged by companies who threaten to move out or otherwise change things to the great detriment of workers. There's still a labor movement there. What do you make of the possibilities of some, and it's very important to try and reconstruct an economy that permits workers to earn a decent living and peasants to survive.
I think the balance sheet is mixed on the positive side, and this goes back to the late years of the Mubarak era. Workers at individual factories, at individual companies, have actually a very good record of winning on bread and butter demands, and so there have been numerous strikes at major state-owned and even some privately owned companies where the management has been forced by worker militancy to give in on a lot of demands, and that has resulted in concrete improvements in standard of living. That's on that level. On the sort of national political level and the sort of coalescence of the labor movement as a political force, the balance sheet is maybe not so positive. And that's because since the Nasser era, the main union body has been basically an arm of the state, and so that's been a force to suppress worker militancy, and that continues to be the case, by the way. And after the downfall of Mubarak, there is a fairly large independent labor movement that is a direct result of those victories in the late Mubarak years, and that's a positive thing. But that independent movement has split, and the sort of political events are going to exacerbate those splits, I think. One of the major independent union figures has become the new Minister of Labor in the interim cabinet that's been empowered by the coup. Some people in the labor movement will support that. Others will not. Others will see that as cooperation with the military, which, of course, is not a pro-worker force. So there just isn't, on a sort of national political level, there just isn't a single force that is going to play a major role. I mean, there are, and that goes for the left, too. I mean, there are numerous groups on the Egyptian left And many of them are quite well organized and quite brave and have played an important role in street battles. They simply aren't numerous enough or unified enough to be a major player on the national stage at this juncture.
Mm-hmm. What about the sort of the Egyptian peasantry? I mean, there's still some small farmers, even if the big cotton farms are sort of in whatever the other major sort of industrialized agriculture is trying to take over. But also sort of rural Egypt. Is there outside of the big cities and amongst, ordinary working people, are there traditions of sort of traditions that are actually quite democratic and communitarian, at least democratic, that could, in fact, be added to the mix towards some kinds of democratic outcomes?
Sure, and there are lots of small farmers left in Egypt, and one of the this is still one of the sort of untold stories of this period in Egypt. Going back to the uprising that unseated Mubarak, we don't have, or at least if I haven't read it, if there is such a thing, we don't have a very clear picture of how and in what way the countryside participated in that uprising. Nor do we have a very good idea of how politics in those places has changed, and that's because analysis of Egypt tends to be very Cairocentric, and that includes, we don't know very much about the provincial towns and cities, which is unfortunate because those places have been important. I think that there are communitarian and small d democratic traditions in the countryside that can be mobilized. There are also somewhat less democratic forces that are easy to mobilize in the countryside, and one of them is patronage. Unfortunately, because of the way politics has been practiced in Egypt for decades, many Egyptians are more likely to support political figures or elites who can basically promise to bring home the bacon, if you will, than they are to support people who want to empower them, per se. Those patterns assert themselves. They're very deeply rooted, and they're particularly powerful in the countryside, where they can sort of also mobilize people along tribal and village lines and things like that. So all of those things are in play in rural areas, and in the elections to date, the rural areas have tended to be more supportive of status quo forces, whatever those are, than they have of the ones that are more dynamic and seeking a greater degree of change.
This is KABU Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Chris Tonsig, who's the editor of the journal Middle East Report. You might look it up, even subscribe. But a lot of the articles are on the net, free of charge. They're really a wonderful resource. Chris, let's talk about the future and the U.S.
From all indications, the Obama administration intends to continue the longstanding U.S. policy toward Egypt, which basically posits that the true U.S. ally in Egypt is the Egyptian army. And you can see that very clearly in the refusal of the administration to date to label the events in July a coup, even though they obviously were. A democratically elected president was removed at the point of a gun. That's not a coup, what is. But the Obama administration will not call it a coup because U.S. law would require that U.S. aid to Egypt be interrupted as a result. And since a lot of that aid goes to the Egyptian military, and the U.S. sees the Egyptian military as kind of the backbone in many ways of its security architecture in the greater Middle East, that's simply not going to happen. I think, this is bad for the concept that U.S. policy has credibility as in the Middle East as something supporting freedom and democracy. Obviously, like, once again, the U.S. looks very hypocritical, very selective at best in to whom it uses to apply the term Democrat, and so on. That's nothing new. That's been the case for decades. So I don't know that this affects U.S. prestige per se. And I think, in general, there is only so much that the U.S. can do to affect the trajectory of the political change that's occurring in Egypt. The prime movers are on the ground. Now, that's not to say the U.S. can do nothing. And, you know, again, if the U.S. wants to stand on the side of real democracy, small d, and real participatory politics and social justice and all of that, then it should put aid to the Egyptian military on the chopping block, or at least make it conditional on serious political reforms. But I have no confidence that the Obama administration or a successor administration would be prepared to take that step.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about it, you know, the fate of, let's say, Egypt and the rest of the Middle East and many other countries on the planet, it seems to me for all the peripheral countries and the, quote, developing countries, as long as international economic arrangements remain the same, that is, both bleeding the bottom half in order to keep enriching the top in one way or another. There are so many mechanisms that they're doing it. It seems to me a place like Egypt is going to be a turmoil. It's very hard to find any kind of possible agreement amongst the various, you know, contesting forces in a country that's impoverished. Or is always facing impoverishment, and Egypt is facing even worse impoverishment under the World Bank, IMF, whatever neoliberal economic policies of squeezing food subsidies and eliminating health care. It seems to me that basically the democratic forces in Egypt are dependent on changes in international economic, or at least the people of Egypt, and changing the overall economic policy. That puts a lot of burden on us. We only have another 30 seconds, Chris. Sorry, but why don't you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's basically true. But there are still sort of changes that,
right,
that Egyptians can achieve for themselves at the margins. And one campaign that President Morsi also helped to stymie, which would have been significant, there was a popular campaign to drop Egypt's debt, that basically the new Egyptian government would refuse to pay this massive debt burden that Mubarak had incurred. And so that's an example of something that the Egyptian people,
sure,
could demand and achieve that would help, though it wouldn't create prosperity, it would help.
Right. And there's so many, there are other countries too, that there is a really major international push in that direction. Thanks so much for talking to us, Chris Stonesig of Middle East Report.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
Cairo Liberation Front.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michel, and you've just heard a clip from the compilation album from the Cairo Liberation Front. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with Chris Tonesing of the Middle East Research and Information Project about recent events in Egypt. Later on the show, we'll hear from our book mole, Larry Bolden, about Susanna Moore's novel of World War II Europe, The Life of Objects, and a talk between Denise Morris and journalist Yasmin Nair about ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and activism on U.S. labor law. But up next, we'll hear from Joe Clement and his guests, Adam and Daisy, and their baby Sabo, about developing an egalitarian worker-owned resource for the Portland community.
Well, good morning. Last May, Fran Michelle and I reviewed a documentary by a Portland area filmmaker called Shift Change, which is about the broad landscape of the cooperative movement, the worker-owned and usually managed cooperative movement. I'm joined here today by two local Portland residents, Adam and Daisy, to talk about a different kind of worker collective that was not really represented well in the film, and Fran and I had spoke to that somewhat. Thanks for joining us, Adam and Daisy.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thanks.
Tell us, first of all, you know, what the idea for your worker-owned, it's going to be a public house, you say, is.
Well, the basic idea behind it is we want to go ahead and start a public house in kind of that old tradition of essentially being a place for community to come in and gather and share with drinks and food, and specifically with beer on this end. And I think most importantly, what we're really focusing on is for it to be collectively run and owned by the people who are working it.
When you talk about, you know, pub in the traditional style, how are you thinking of that compared to pubs that we know about now?
Right. So pubs now is just a term that is liberally used by a lot of different establishments that just happen to serve alcohol. And public house traditionally being a place where people from the community would come and be able to gather and actually talk about things and share things, and it oftentimes would include food and everything like that, but it's certainly been American tradition to kind of spin that more towards being a just an alcohol establishment.
And I would just add that, just like Adam was just saying, it's about community, and that's a really important aspect of this entire project. As a community.
Now, we all had gone to see this documentary, Shift Change, last year when it actually was showing at the Hollywood Theater, and we all kind of walked out thinking that there was certain perspectives on the stakes of worker ownership in a class society like we live in. And I was wondering whether you could speak to what you see as different about what you all want to start.
Yeah, so there are some pretty big differences in... to just pull out a really specific example that was widely used in Shift Change was the Mondragon collectives in Catalonia. And those specifically still having, while worker-owned, having hierarchical structures and having managers and different positions of power going on. And specifically, the difference here is that our belief is that the business itself should be run and managed collectively by the workers who are working it. It's their lives and their labor that are being affected by the conditions of the work, by what it is that they're doing, whether it be anything from shifts to hazardous things or just decisions about what to put on the menu and what not to. And that all that power should be rested with the workers themselves. So it's a little bit of a different system. It's far more democratic. And along the lines that we're running, we right now are using a full consensus model, but there's a whole litany of other ways that you can collectively run and democratically run a business.
Interesting that you make distinctions along those lines. Recently, we have heard our station manager refer to KABU as a corporation, as if to say, don't you realize that you are already participating in the form of organization that you have problems with? And you all seem pretty conscious of that in your decision to place the workers and the people doing the actual work of the organization at the forefront of decision-making processes. And I'm wondering whether you could speak to what that offers, not just, you know, the people being served beer or food or whatever, but the community in terms of teaching democratic values.
I'll speak to that. I think that the most important thing for me is a non-hierarchical workplace. And in my entire experience of working, I started working when I was like 15 and continued to work in the food industry and other sort of service establishments, I'm never considered. I've never been, people don't ask me what I think. And that's very dehumanizing. And I would say that that's a really important part of it, is to be included, to be considered, and to have a voice and a say in the regular operations of the workplace.
And as far as it has it affects the community, I think that coming in and creating examples of democracy taking place in action that people can look at and see that they work, and that they are actually easy to participate in, and that what it really requires is simply a familiarity with the actual processes that are there. Frankly, right now, we're all very familiar with hierarchical top-down work situations, as most of us experience every day of our lives. And if we had the same sort of socialization towards democratic process, I think we would be able to go through that with just as much ease. So as far as running within the community and creating a space that is democratic, it allows us not only to help show by example different processes, but hopefully will allow more than anything the community to actually have more of a say in the business, because instead of the business simply being by one person with their own interest in mind, it'll be, even though its decisions are made by the workers are a part of the community. These are the communities that we come from. So the community's voice is going to be far more represented, because it's going to be more diverse voices being represented within the business itself.
So it's not just you and Adam who want to start up this pub.
Right. So far we have two other collective members, and we're looking to add three more. So for a total of 7 collective members.
What kind of food and drink and community space do y'all want to offer?
So we want to focus on beer, mead, and wine from the Cascadia region. So not just local beers from Portland. As far as food goes, we are looking for regional and sustainable food with a menu focused around new and traditional hot sandwiches. And we're going to be omnivore. But we are going to be very vegan friendly as well. And as far as community space, I would just say again that it's about the pub. We're not going to have specifically a community space. We want the whole space to be considered community. And it's going to be very family friendly, because I think that a lot of the times is not considered. And children are very much a part of our community as well.
So this, I want to remind listeners, is a project in development, and you're looking to have a informational potluck that you're inviting the community to come participate in.
Yeah, so we're going to be having a potluck at Laurelhurst Park starting at 4, going till pretty much darkish, I guess. It's going to be on the 26th of this month. And what we're going to be doing is having a bunch of people bring out food. We're going to have a whole lot of different lawn games, just a place for people to hang out. We will have alcohol there as well. We'll have a few different kegs of beer, which are going to be pretty awesome. We've got some captured by porches and also a couple of really amazing local microbrew kind of stuff that you can't get anywhere else. And as part of this also, we'll have a big old informational booth set up that'll be talking about a little bit more about what we're doing, what we're trying to see, and also really specifically, because this is obviously early in our development, taking solicitations for different ideas. And that's what we really want. We're trying to get people's feedback and input. Part of that is that we haven't really focused in on an exact location where we want to be yet. We have some neighborhoods that we're thinking about. We have some places that we're trying to stay away from. We're trying to be really considerate about what kind of a neighborhood we do actually move into, and where you put the business, and the type of effects that might have on the neighborhood, specifically, right, talking about ideas of gentrification and different issues around that, and making sure that the business itself fits the neighborhood that's going into. So we'll have a little map up of that, and we'll be looking for input from people about good locations, whether it be in your community or wherever it is in Portland. And we'll also be taking solicitations for things like name. We haven't come up with a name yet. We've been throwing around ideas, but haven't really fell on anything yet, so we're still working on that. I will have cooked up a few different things that we're hopefully be featuring our menu that we're giving a try out, and we'll be talking about our menu more and trying to take more ideas for that as well. So really just looking to interact with people, have a good time, eat some good food, play games, and drink beer in the park, and just kind of talk about what we're trying to do.
This has been Joe Clement talking with Adam and Daisy about worker-owned and collectively managed businesses, in particular one that they want to start here soon, a worker-owned and collectively managed pub. Well, thanks for joining us, Adam and Daisy.
Well, thanks, Joe.
Thanks for having us, Joe.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I've been Joe Clement.
The comments are right up Earth, and you wouldn't close the land all around the Earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and sheet. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you say these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools.
That was David Rovics on The Commons. And before that, Joe, Adam, and Daisy, and Baby Sabo on developing an egalitarian public pub in Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Later, we'll hear from Denise Morris and Yasmin Nair on other kinds of work situations in America. But first, we'll turn to our book mole, Larry Bolden, for his comments on Susanna Moore's novel, The Life of Objects.
Good morning. Coming-of-age stories almost always interest me, no matter the country or the period of time. The Life of Objects by Susanna Moore is an extraordinary coming-of-age novel about an Irish girl, Beatrice, who wants nothing more than to escape her cruel and restrictive mother and her Irish village. She is 17 when her story starts, but in most ways a very young 17 due to her mother's tight, cold rein on her life. A Protestant girl in a mostly Catholic town and not allowed to associate with any Catholics, her single outlet, both emotionally and intellectually, is the Church of Ireland cleric Mr. Knox, who keeps a small school and who has a passion for birds. There being no lending library in Ballycarra, it is through the books loaned her by Mr. Knox that she learns of the larger world. Quote, Mr. Knox liked to say that novels help to show us that the world is a place of strangeness ruled by chance, which makes it difficult to maintain our certainties. I had no certainties other than my desire to leave Ballycarra. Close quote. And leave she does, through a series of happenstances she could not have foreseen. She says of her mother, quote, her disappointments had rendered her bitter and unkind. My father and I were in constant dread of her. I lived in a chaos of desire and disappointment, close quote. Her mother takes her out of school at 15, thinking that Mr. Knox is filling her head with ideas that would do her no good in the world of haberdashery, and installs her in the small shop owned by the family. She's not allowed to read in the shop, quote, lest it appear that I gave myself airs, close quote. And so, using materials stolen from the shop, she teaches herself to crochet, and then to make lace. Eventually, her father not only secretly provides her with thread, but begins to display pieces of lace she has made in the shop. The fine lace work is seen by a wealthy woman, who gives her two books of lace patterns, and this in turn leads to an encounter with a foreign woman, Countess Hartenfels, and finally an invitation to escort the Countess to Berlin, where Beatrice will live as a lacemaker in the house of a wealthy family, the Metzenbergs. What I have not mentioned is that this move, so thrilling for the young Beatrice, occurs in 1938, just as Germany has launched its aggressive campaign across Europe. Felix Metzenberg, besides being a wealthy collector of art, has been a politically influential force in Germany who served in the Great War, and whose memory of that time makes him extremely skeptical of the Nazi Party and its campaign. Having refused a foreign ambassadorship position in the new regime, he is looked at with suspicion and soon decides to leave Berlin and take his treasures to a country house where he will be less scrutinized. Although he offers to pay Beatrice's passage back to Ireland and warns her that he may not be able to protect her in the uncertain future, she elects to remain with the family. I've told this much of the story, which the reader gets in the first 30 pages or so, simply to set up the dangers and moral dilemmas that face the family as the war continues and enlarges. While the Metzenbergs opposed the tactics and ambitions of Hitler and the Nazi Party from the beginning, they obviously have to do so with great care. All during the war, they harbor Jews and others who are perceived as enemies of the regime and return to a kind of feudalism with regards to the villagers who come to depend on them for produce, employment, and various forms of protection from the authorities. What I found particularly fascinating about this book was the view of it from inside Germany and through the eyes of a family whose sympathies lie with the Allied forces of Europe and who rejoice even at the bombing of Berlin, when the bombs are being dropped on them. Not only the rich and powerful in Germany, but even many of the poor villagers still close their eyes to the rumors of the murder of Jewish prisoners and at least pretend that, quote, the humiliation and misery inflicted on the country were in part the fault of the Jews who had forgotten their place, close quote. Felix argues against such views, both with the villagers and his rich friends, quote, Felix said that he once believed that humanism had been founded on the shared need to know. It had grown more and more apparent to him, however, that the opposite was true. We were united by our shared need not to know. By the time that we understand what is happening, he said, we are already complicit. Close quote. In spite of the fact that I was born in 1941, the year America finally entered the war, I continue to be astounded by my own ignorance of the immensity of loss, the unbearable hardship of so many from so many countries. My view of Pearl Harbor was that of a few Japanese planes somehow reaching Hawaii to sink a few ships, not of the nearly 400 planes that flew in three waves to sink 18 ships and leave 3,000 dead. And although I have read about the firebombing of Dresden, I had no idea that in March of 1945, 1,000 B-17 bombers destroyed the center of Berlin. Perhaps reading novels is a lazy way of learning history, but I'm so grateful to novelists like Moore who do such meticulous research and then so skillfully put into real flesh and blood stories about the suffering and bravery of millions of Europeans, Russians, and, yes, Germans. As the tide begins to turn and Germany begins to lose the war on many fronts, the lives of the Metzenbergs and the villagers become even more difficult, and unfortunately, even with the surrender of Germany in the advancing armies of Russia and America, the lives of Germans who had resisted the Nazis and at least covertly aided the Allies do not magically become better. Whether it is German soldiers looting and ravaging the land as they retreat, or the victorious Russians doing about the same as they occupy, the lives of rural farmers and thousands upon thousands of refugees fleeing first one way and then the other continue to spiral out of control. This is a searingly sad story, but told through the compassionate eyes of Beatrice, there is something beautiful and profound about it. I leave you with her words, quote, During the war, we had scavenged at night and slept in the day. Children had not gone to school. Animals had not foaled. There had been no appointments to keep or to cancel, no market days, weddings, or funerals, and no cars, buses, trains, or horses to get us there, had there been some place to go. There had been no telephones, electricity, petrol, no medicine, no money, no food. We had survived, but we were different people. Close quote. I've been talking about Susanna Moore's The Life of Objects. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Adam Aston's 1935 version of Cocktails for Two, a song referenced in Susanna Moore's novel The Life of Objects, just reviewed by Book Mole Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour today. You can find Larry's review as well as the whole show in a day or two posted to the KBOO website under the audio tab on our show page. You can listen again or share it with your friends. Next, we turn to Denise Morris for a discussion with Yasmin Nair about queer rights, anti-discrimination legislation, and labor law.
Thank you, Fran. This is Denise Morris with The Old Mole. Yasmin Nair, welcome to KABU.
Hi, Denise. Thank you for having me back on.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us this morning. Let me remind folks who you are. You are a regular contributor with The Old Mole, and you're our activist and writer in Chicago. Your work has appeared in many publications, including GLQ, The Progressive, Makeshift, The Bolerico Project, Windy City Times, Bitch Magazine, No More Potlucks, and Maximum Rock and Roll. As well, Yasmin, you are a co-founder and member of the Editorial Collective Against Equality. That's a digital archive of queer writing and art that challenges the politics of inclusion. And your activist work includes immigration, gentrification, public education, and youth at risk. As I said, you're a regular contributor with us on The Old Mole, and we do appreciate you coming on. Yasmin, recently you wrote a piece published in .429 magazine. It was at the end of May, called Enda, We Hardly Know Ya. And you're exploring the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And let's start with that act. The ENDA's just recently been reintroduced and actually passed through a Senate committee and appears to be looking like it may pass. It's really renewed a lot of hope for folks that it will pass. It's been 20 years in the works, and it's a very well-traveled piece of legislation that has had many incarnations. So tell us a bit about the history of ENDA and what it is as well.
It's basically, ENDA is basically legislation which would prohibit discrimination in hiring and employment on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. And it applies only to civilian, non-religious employers with, but not to anyone who has fewer than 15 employees. So it doesn't apply to small businesses. And it's been around, as you said, for about 20 years in various incarnations. It's always been extremely controversial. In 2007, it reached the height of controversy when the human rights campaign known as HRC, the major, largest, an extremely wealthy gay rights organization, Human Rights Campaign, refused to support a version that was transgender inclusive. And the resulting fallout is still something that HRC has never really quite recovered from. The current incarnation has the full support of many trans-led organizations, including the National Center for Transgender Equality, the NCTE. You know, and we can talk about what the trans-inclusive parts of this legislation might be. And I'm not surprised that it is doing a lot better than in previous years. I would not be surprised if it actually passed, precisely because I think it's riding the crest out of gay marriage, out of the DOMA decision, for instance, and out of, I think, a larger, perhaps sweeping sense across this country, for better or for worse, that this is somehow symptomatic of a version of gay / trans queer rights. I would say LGBT rights rather than queer. So it's not entirely surprising. It may well pass. Yeah, that's sort of the short history of that.
Well, part of its history has to do with of course, why it hasn't passed. It always seems to me so odd that these things don't pass, because in fact, as you argue in your piece, ENDA is not entirely toothless, but it really certainly lacks the ability, of course, to address, like any anti-discrimination legislation for around race, sex, and the like, these things don't guarantee anything. Particularly, they don't guarantee workplace justice. But one thing I find interesting about it and a not being able to pass is that, of course, the argument being that LGBT people cannot necessarily be proven as a suspect class, meaning then that an Employment Non-Discrimination Act would actually turn out to be special treatment in the workplace. So partly that being based on the idea that gays choose to be gay, unlike race or sex or nationality, etc. You have a very interesting response to this and make some very good points. I wanted you to talk about that. And particularly, you say, you know, that the activism around this or the rhetoric around this goes back to this idea that homosexuality is innate and beyond one's control.
Right, and I think that's how they've managed to garner much more support in recent years and in this particular incarnation. They even managed to get the American Psychological Association to push for its support, essentially saying that psychologists do not consider sexual orientation, I'm quoting here, do not consider sexual orientation for most people to be a conscious choice that can be voluntarily changed. And the other issue that has been tweaked in this particular incarnation of the legislation is how it applies to transgender people in particular. So in order to claim that one has been discriminated, one first has to establish that one did everything to be the right kind of gay / trans person. So transgender people, for instance, have to demonstrate that as trans employees, they were making every attempt to transition fully into their desired gender, right? So in other words, what is peculiar to me about ENDA is that it's actually affirming a different kind of discrimination against those who don't fit the mold. The legislation is very clear, by the way, about how trans people must adhere to certain rules about clothing, for instance. They must wear clothing that's appropriate to their gender. In fact, it says that it allows employers, and I use again the terminology from the legislation, dictate dress or grooming standards, and that they need to conform to the expectations of their quote-unquote intended gender. So this actually, again, this is all, I think, a matter of concern for us, especially because most people, as you pointed out, yes, first of all, I think it's important to also point out that we do need some sense of the need for a non-discrimination policy, and we need, I think, a larger cultural idea that people should not be discriminated against regardless of who they are and regardless of whether or not they choose to be who they are, right? And I think you can also argue that applies to gender, it applies to race. You know, how one chooses to identify racially, for instance, has also, as we know, in U.S. law, been a slippery slope for many. So I think but at the same time, you know, I think people like me, all of us who are concerned about what an actual radical queer politics around employment can look like, are in this sort of strange position where we understand that, yes, people are constantly discriminated against because they are gay and lesbian, transgender people. At the same time, that the only alternatives that we're presented with are these kind of extremely flawed, extremely problematic alternatives which require LGBT people to conform to society's expectations of how to perform as gay and lesbian and transgender. And I think that's a central conundrum that this legislation does not address. In fact, it reifies that particular kind of discrimination. It basically says, if you don't look like a good trans person, we can and we will discriminate against you. So in other words, you have no case. Right? This is what the legislation is actually saying. You have no case if you don't pass. And I think we ought to consider the horrific implications of that. But more importantly, you know, when it comes to employment matters, when it comes to workplace issues, we have to start, and when I say we, I mean the radical progressive wing of all of us in this community, larger community, need to push back at groups that are pushing for this legislation and ask, so what are you doing for the fact that every state except Montana in the United States is an at-will state, right? So, for instance, the Human Rights Campaign is now using this tagline over and over on Twitter, on social media, everywhere. It says, you know, in 34 states, it's legal to be fired for being gay, which ignores the fact that in every state, it is perfectly legal to be fired for no reason whatsoever. I live in Illinois, one of those states. Again, every state except Montana. And I think this is all part and parcel of what my friend and colleague Mariam Kaba at Project NIA calls the retrenchment of an extraordinarily conservative form of neoliberalism that we are watching, and which is to say that the way in which our political economic landscape is being reformulated to actually shut down opportunities for millions and to accrue wealth and influence in the hands of a few. So marriage, you know, the recent DOMA decision, which was entirely based around the fortune of a rather wealthy lesbian woman who's worth at around $10 million, but it was involved in a case which made it seem like this was somehow in have benefits for the majority of gays and lesbians, right? So there's a way in which there's a kind of retrenchment of that of matters that will only benefit. Marriage as an economic benefit is only a benefit as such for those who already have the wealth that they need to keep within their estates. In the same way, when we're talking about matters like ENDA, the kind of employment discrimination that it supposedly seeks to end is really only something that's going to apply to people who are in relatively large employment situations in, say, large law firms, for instance. I mean, you know, any law firm, for instance, that has more than 15 is a pretty substantial law firm right there. And also it requires that the poorest among us, perhaps, those who can't afford to transition, quote-unquote, properly, or the genderqueer amongst us, those who don't want to transition properly, are just basically left to rot. So I think, when it comes to, I'm sort of struck by the fact that ENDA is now becoming more successful in the wake of DOMA, in the wake of DADT, all of which are these gay issues that purport to be progressive wins, radical wins even, but they're actually being extended on the backs of the poorest and most marginal, and those who don't want to conform to certain expectations of society, those who don't want to join the military as a form of economic mobility, for instance, those who don't want to marry for health care or because they just don't want to marry, and for those who will not pass in the case of ENDA, right? And for those who will not pass, who will not be the good gays and the good transgender people. I think that what that says about our current political and economic landscape is something that we have not reflected upon.
Yasmin Nair, this is Denise Morris with the Old Mole Variety Hour. We just have a minute left. We were talking about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. With our last minute, I think I'd like to remind folks of what happened with the Walmart case. And again, we just have a minute, but I think this puts some perspective on this situation because this was a mass discrimination lawsuit that was basically thrown out on a technicality that involved sex discrimination for the largest employer in the country. And we'll finish
with
that.
Right, and again, I think it also points us to the danger of placing so much upon purely legal recourse. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, and I think Liza Featherstone and others have written about this. Legal recourse is extremely important. The law, the courts are extremely important. But this is exactly what happens when we base our expectations of non-discrimination, for instance, upon something like legal recourse purely. We need to have a longer, more entrenched conversation about how to make non-discrimination a part of employment. Right?
Right. Not and we'll have to finish up there. And a great piece in the .429 magazine. We will link to your piece there and also your website because you're always busy writing about all sorts of things. Yasmin Nair, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Denise.
I get a pat on the fanny fanny. Don't look at me like I'm a $2 trendy trendy. I'll stay for your tie to your eyes. Better think again next time. You wanna survey my behind.
Oh, oh, she gonna call on you tonight. Oh, oh, she gonna make you serve time.
That was the JB Dubs singing I Hate My Job, following Denise Morris talking with Yasmin Nair. Thanks to both of them and to Joe Clement for engineering and for his talk with Adam and Daisy. Thanks to Larry Bolden and to Bill Resnick and Chris Tonsing. I'm Fran Michelle. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland. Stay tuned to KBOO. At 10, we'll hear an interview with Miko Pelid, an Israeli peace activist and the author of The General's Son. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks with Ryan Alexander of Taxpayers for Common Sense about the cumulative effects of shipping millions of tons of coal via train from Montana and Wyoming to ports on the West Coast. At 11, hear Disability Awareness with host Grace Reed. And at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, hear a conversation with local author Shannon P.S. Bonet, sharing moments of her life from her memoir, Mommy, Are You Listening? Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support in our one-day flash drive this past Friday. If you missed it, you can still become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Thanks for listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and the Sound Outside, the Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.